This is Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson. What you hear right there is some wood-on-wood action.
Red clay, once again threatening. Oh,
the players are on a field holding two sticks, one in each hand. The sticks look like modern-day lacrosse sticks, but with smaller net pockets. Like lacrosse, they're trying to pass a ball through two goals on opposite sides of the field. Unlike lacrosse, drummers stand on the sidelines, beating fast or slow, depending on the pace of the game. This predates baseball diamonds, football end zones, soccer fields, because this is the oldest field sport in America, Choctaw stickball.
It's an ancient game. The Choctaws and all the Southeastern American Indians have played it for centuries, thousands of years, I guess.
This is Tammy Greer, director for the Center for American Indian Research and Studies at the University of Southern Mississippi. She coaches the university's co-ed Choctaw Stickball League with dozens of Native players.
Stickball also had a spiritual component. It was like they fasted before stickball. They refrained from certain foods, refrained from certain activities. It wasn't just a game. It was a way of life.
Lenina Grace John is a junior at Southern Miss. She's a Choctaw and stickball player.
The Choctaw word for the game of stickball is called kobochatuli. The ball is called tua, and the sticks are called kobocha. It's the strongest culture of our tribe, and we want to, you know, keep ties with that.
Isn't it cool that this game is still played? An American Indian sport being played right now on college campuses. But what's really wild is that I actually called Lenina and Tammy to see what they knew about the history of this sport being passed down. Because at some point, enslaved people in Louisiana picked up stickball and started playing it regularly.
Did anyone ever talk to you about the fact that slaves in Louisiana and New Orleans and maybe in Mississippi too actually used to play this?
I had not heard of it, but you realize that people who lived around plantation homes and the Indians lived on the outskirts of plantation homes, so there was lots of mingling and mixing and sharing.
I think there would have been nothing unusual about enslaved persons of African descent having very real social relationships, personal relationships with indigenous peoples.
This is Rashauna Johnson, an assistant professor of history at Dartmouth College. She studied slavery in New Orleans and learned about this version of stickball passed down to the enslaved communities called raquette.
I had no idea this had ever happened. And I happened upon a newspaper from the 1850s that reported firsthand accounts and scores. And I thought, what is this? Why is this report about enslaved people at play in this newspaper?
Interesting she'd never heard of it, because not only is she a historian.
I am a New Orleanian, so when I...
Oh, I didn't even know that all this time. Rashauna, you've been holding out on me. Check, please.
Seriously, she didn't tip me off to this until the end of our interview. Anyway, the write-up she's talking about is from an 1858 issue of the New Orleans Daily Crescent, and it mentioned that these matches between slaves happened on Sundays, their one day of rest.
There seemed to be two important teams, the LaVille party and the Bayou party.
The city team and the country team. They had uniforms, they had mascots, they were referees. It was the real deal. And they'd play this highly physical and physically taxing sport in front of a large, raucous crowd of mostly white men, many of them their masters, who cheered them on.
A huge portion of their identities as people, as masters, as men in particular, are made up of their ability to master black people. And so I think it would boost one's masculinity or manhood to possess this enslaved man who'd shown this level of dominance on the raquette field.
The team that won spent the rest of the afternoon parading into the French Quarter, their white masters partying alongside them. A bizarre shared victory. You're listening to Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson. Historians of slavery have their own set of questions around topics, a big one being power. How do you master another human being? Rashauna drops a phrase I wasn't expecting. safety valves.
On the one hand, we certainly think a lot about force, right? There's a reason we think about whips and chains in the context of slavery, for sure. But this business of safety valves raises the idea that instead of allowing a completely repressive society that doesn't allow any kind of amusement or any kind of enjoyment, in some instances, we see these kinds of structured, allowed amusements, if you will, that allow people to blow off steam, so to speak, right? In hopes that you prevent the buildup of the kinds of resentments that would then ostensibly lead to the more large-scale rebellions.
She says that perpetuating slavery was also dependent on good old white male bonding. White males bonding as equals. On the sidelines of the racquet field, the rich and the poor united.
As they gaze upon these black bodies on the field, that allows them to not have to pay a whole lot of attention to the very real class distinctions that separated them. And so this performance of blackness on the field did something useful in a larger society that was, on the one hand, deeply unequal, and that also needed total white buy-in into a system of black slavery.
Hearing Roshana use the word gaze made me wonder if there was an element of desire tacked on to this entertainment. 100%, she says.
There's this strange inconsistency that the spectators are cheering on the virility of these bodies that they at the same time dread having to face in a slave revolt. And so I do think that there is something that's going on at a sort of homoerotic level in which we have to sort of think about what it means for this mostly male environment that these people can engage in this seemingly thoroughly violent spectacle while ultimately resting assured that it will be contained in a way that will never ultimately threaten the spectator.
You know, you're kind of explaining this violent collision type sport, and I'm thinking of the sounds blaring from my neighbor's TV. You know, and so I'm just, you know, wondering if you make those connections, you know, thinking about racquet in the antebellum period of New Orleans and the 21st century NFL.
Absolutely. I mean, the connections in this question of sort of violence, sport, and black male bodies in particular, I think that sport, on the one hand, can be held forward as being really generative, and we have these really great stories of the ways that sports can bring communities together and can bring people together across all sorts of racial lines and regional lines and religious lines and so on. And I think that that's absolutely important. But I think we also have to think about it alongside some of these other questions about this other larger history of exploitation.
Roshana's right when it comes to the ways sports can be framed. During the Reconstruction era, when racquet was no longer played, it pretty much died out at the end of the Civil War, many white Southerners looked back on the sport as a time when blacks and whites supposedly got along.
There was this idea that there was this harmony in the antebellum South because the blacks were generally enslaved or generally understood their places, and that was a critical part of maintaining a harmonious society.
There's another Daily Crescent article, this one from 1897, which speaks to this. Quote, "The good old time when domestic harmony was all that could be desired, and when blacks and whites were so happy and contented in playing or in witnessing the noble game of racquet."
That kind of account is certainly infused with this nostalgic understanding of the Old South in which people knew their places, right? But proximity is not the same as equality, right? And so I think that integration alone or proximity alone or multiracialism alone do not necessarily make impossible these other kinds of structural hierarchies that then and even into the present continue to create different life possibilities for different people.
Tripod is a production of WWNO New Orleans Public Radio in collaboration with the Historic New Orleans Collection and the University of New Orleans Midlow Center for New Orleans Studies. Special thanks to Evan Christopher for the opening theme music. Catch Tripod on the air Thursdays during Morning Edition and again on Mondays during All Things Considered. To hear this episode of Tripod again, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and write a review. It helps other people find us. You can also go to WWNO.org, where you can see videos of Choctaw stickball in action. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson, and I'll tripod you later.